Welcome to the History Podcast, guys. This is your host, Jason Thomason. Let's get started. Welcome to the show. Today, we're going to be talking about Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is the 28th president of the United States. He is a Democrat, and he has a very interesting background in the sense that he is one of the more academic presidents. He's very scholarly. He has a background in education, a background in teaching. He's going to be a professor at the college level at Princeton. He also, one of his first jobs was in Charleston, South Carolina, which was during Reconstruction, and he got to see firsthand the devastation of war. As Charleston was pretty much burned to the ground after the American Civil War, and he got a firsthand look at what war can do. And that will play, I believe, a role in his presidency as we get further into this episode. You know, it's his story as an academic is one where he's going to be a professor. He's going to work his way all the way up to becoming the president of, the president of Princeton University. And there are so many people in New Jersey that are just enthralled with the charisma, with the intellect that Woodrow Wilson brings to the table. Now, he has no political background, none. But people believe that he has the chops to represent the Democratic Party, possibly even one day as a potential president of the United States. They just kind of believe he has the makeup for that. Now, his first political stop is going to be in 1902 when the Democrats convince him to run for governor of New Jersey. Now, at the time, he was convinced to run by many of the more conservative Democratic political bosses. Once he is nominated and wins, he will prove that he is a progressive nominee, and that ruffles the feather of many of those conservative political bosses who nominated him thinking that he was going to be fitting right into the status quo of the Democratic Party at that time. And just like Teddy Roosevelt and just like William Howard Taft, this is why we call these guys the progressive era presidents, because they believed it was their job to protect the American people, because nobody else at that time seemed to be willing to step in and help. But before we get into his presidency, I want to kind of touch just a little bit more on the election of 1912, because we didn't get quite into it as much as I wanted to in the previous episode on Teddy Roosevelt. But 1912, you have three candidates. You have the incumbent, William Howard Taft, very conservative. Although he is a progressive-minded guy, he's more conservative than Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, but he is progressive-minded, and he's got a lot done in his time in office. But he has an opponent in Teddy Roosevelt, who used to be his best friend, and now they are political rivals, who is running as a third-party candidate, a party that he affectionately called the Bull Moose Party. Then you have Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is the Democratic nominee. And these three are the big progressive presidents of our era. And they're all running against each other in 1912. And that's a pretty cool thing that you don't see very often. You know, usually it's the third party candidate's a guy that's obscure that you haven't heard of. But this is a former president. A guy who took over in 1901, won his own term in 1904, and would have probably been elected again if he chose to run in 1908, but stepped away and wants to get back in the game in 1912. The other candidate is the incumbent, and now you have what will be the future president of the United States. It's just a pretty cool dynamic that you rarely, in fact, you've never seen that before in American history. Despite what Taft's campaign tried to convince the American people of, the two real candidates in this election are going to be Teddy Roosevelt, the Bull Moose Party candidate, and Woodrow Wilson, the challenger from the Democratic Party. Taft has no real chance at winning. And quite frankly, neither does Teddy Roosevelt, because of the three candidates in the election. They're going to, him and Taft will split each other's votes. But there are three major issues of the election that I want to kind of hit on real quickly and kind of show you the differences between Wilson and Teddy on these three issues. Number one was trust. Trust were a big issue of this era. Trust were crushing competition. Trusts were becoming so large that it was becoming a major detriment, not only to competitors, but it was bad for consumers. When competition is crushed, it's bad for the consumer. Wilson opposed all trust, much in the same way that the incumbent president, William Howard Taft, did. Teddy stuck to his guns. Teddy felt the same way in previous elections. He felt that some trusts were good for the country, and he was willing to turn a blind eye. Now, he called it protecting those trusts, but he felt that other trusts were bad for the country, and he was going to make sure to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act on those trusts. The second issue is women's suffrage. Women can't vote right now, okay? And this is a major topic. A large demographic of the country are women, okay? And they want the right to vote. This is in a time where African Americans now have the right to vote because of the 15th Amendment. That was a Reconstruction Amendment, but women were not included in that amendment. And women like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they have been fighting long and hard for women to have the right to vote. The two major candidates, have different viewpoints on this. Wilson believes that it is a states' rights issue and that the states should decide state by state whether or not to allow women to vote. Teddy, on the other hand, openly campaigns that it needs to be federal legislation that women need to have the right to vote. The third is tariffs. And if you understand the time and the place, there's only one real way that the government at this time in 1912 generates real revenue. Okay, yeah, they have taxes on foods and things like that, but that's not enough to generate enough revenue to spend on the American people. The big chunk of revenue that they gain as the government is on tariffs, which is taxes on imported goods. Wilson opposes tariffs. Wilson believes that tariffs are simply a special interest program for big business. All right. But Teddy, on the other hand, supported tariffs because he believed that having tariffs and even raising tariffs possibly would help protect the wages of the American worker. Now, I don't know how you would have voted in 1912, and that's really irrelevant for this podcast, but you can kind of see the three major issues and where both of those major candidates stood. And what's kind of sad is that the guy that kind of gets lost in the shuffle is the current president of the United States, William Howard Taft. But it was a foregone conclusion that Taft really had no chance once Teddy entered the race. And that's why Taft refuses to leave, because he also knows that with him in the race, Roosevelt really has no chance to win either. And this feud is at a boiling point. Well, election day comes, and the results come in. And to show you the effect that the third party had on the election, Wilson wins, but it's narrow. In the popular vote, he only wins 42% of the popular vote. That is not a large margin, ladies and gentlemen. Nonetheless, he wins because Taft and Teddy split each other's votes, and Woodrow Wilson becomes the 28th president of the United States. On the campaign trail, Woodrow Wilson ran on this campaign slogan of the country needing a new freedom. And the New Freedom campaign stressed individual freedom, protecting individual freedoms, and giving more rights back to the states on issues like we just mentioned with women's suffrage. This is in stark contrast with Teddy's new nationalism, and they were kind of vying for who was right and who was more needed in today's day and age of 1912. But as president, Taft is going to really Taft Woodrow Wilson is really going to implement a lot of what was on his agenda, known as the New Freedom. Number one, he's going to sign the Antitrust Act, known as the Clayton Antitrust Act, which is going to strengthen a previous antitrust bill that we've talked about in previous episodes, the Sherman Antitrust Act. One thing that the Clayton Antitrust Act is going to do is strengthen, not only, like I mentioned, the Sherman Antitrust Act, it's also going to protect labor unions. Labor unions are not popular to the big business world. In fact, they see them as a threat to capitalism in general. And the Clayton Antitrust Act is going to give further protections to labor unions. Additionally, it's going to make it tougher for trust to cut crush the competition. And ladies and gentlemen, this is one of the most important concepts that we need to understand about the Progressive Era. They are these presidents, from Teddy to Taft to Wilson, are going to do everything within their constitutional rights. And even, some will argue that they go outside of that because, the Constitution doesn't technically always give them these rights, but they interpret it as if the Constitution says I can't do it, then I'm going to do it. But they're going to go after trusts. The latter two are going to go after just about every trust they can, whereas Teddy kind of sees some trust as good and some trust as bad. But they are going to do everything they can to protect the consumer. Because if you don't protect the competition, if you don't make the competition fair, it doesn't have to be equitable, but you need to make sure that there is true competition in the workplace. And if there is, it's going to be good for the consumer because they will have to vie for their business. But if you crush the competition, as we've seen throughout this period with guys like John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, and we haven't even touched on the railroads back when, Cornelius Vanderbilt and Tom Scott and Leland Stanford and all these guys were running the rates up sky high, crushing the farmers who needed to ship their goods but could not afford it. This is good for competition. The Clayton Antitrust Act is very good, and it is signed to help strengthen the Sherman Antitrust Act. Additionally, during Wilson's administration, he's going to establish an 8-hour workday. This is something that progressives, and even before them, populists, had been pushing for a long time. And during Wilson's administration, we will see the 8-hour workday created. He's also going to bring an end to child labor, a big step in the right direction. He's going to add to a lot of the work that Teddy had done with the national parks. He's going to create the National Park Service to oversee the protected lands that Teddy had already protected in his administration from 1901 to 1908. Wilson will also sign into law the Federal Reserve Act, creating the Federal Reserve. And for those of us that have experience with the Federal Reserve, we understand that the Federal Reserve sets the monetary policy. They regulate the interest rates. One of the things that is very important to Wilson is they will determine how much money is lent to the banks, which in essence, they also regulate how much money is put into circulation. The problem of inflation is a real problem. We see it big time in 2019. The answer to a lot of people's problems is just print more money. Now, we can just print our own money, can't we? Well, the problem with that is you have inflation. The more you print of something, the more you have of anything, the less valuable it is. You have to understand that the more you have of something, the more the price is going to plummet. And the same thing holds true with money. The more money there is, the less valuable it becomes. And so the Federal Reserve is created to kind of regulate those times. They haven't been perfect and they're never going to be perfect. But at least you have a federal agency that is in charge of regulating monetary flow. Additionally, as you've heard in our mini podcast, if you listen to it on the Progressive Era Amendments, he's also going to be the president during The time when the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th Amendments are passed. 16 is going to allow the government to tax your income. This is going to give the government another big chunk of change that will allow them to generate revenue to spend on the American people. Before this, like I mentioned earlier, all they could generate big income or big revenue from was tariffs. Now you have tariffs and you have income taxes. It's a graduated income tax, and I know that it is heavily debated in our own society today in 2019 as to whether we should keep the graduated income tax, whether we should have a flat income tax, whether we should get rid of the 16th Amendment. You know, I don't know what the answer is, and we're not here to debate that today. But the 16th Amendment instituted the income tax. The 17th Amendment called for the direct election of senators. This cuts out the middleman. There is no such thing as the state legislator after the 17th Amendment. Prior to this, the people in that state or district elected a state legislature who then would elect the senators of that state. The 17th Amendment is going to eliminate the state legislature. Now it's a direct election between the people and the state senator. 18 is going to call on prohibition. We all know that didn't work out real well. Led to a lot of crime. People still drank. Okay. And eventually with the 21st Amendment during the Great Depression, it will be repealed. And then 19, a big moment for women. All the years of fighting for their right to vote will come true during the Wilson administration with the 19th Amendment and their right to vote. So that's a look at his domestic policy. But one of the defining moments in Wilson's administration will be his decision to stay neutral during World War I. Wilson is a firm believer that the United States needs to isolate itself. It needs to remain neutral. That this is a European matter that does not need to involve the United States. Now, a little bit of background on World War I itself. Now, this is during a time where Darwinism has kind of turned into social Darwinism, and you have all these nations who believe in the idea of survival of the fittest and that, you know, their nation is the strongest. And so what we begin to see are nations forming these alliances because they are not thinking to themselves, we need friends if there is war. They are forming alliances so that they have friends when there is war. It's a matter of when, not if. And so we start to see this alliance system form. You see Serbia. Serbia will form an alliance with Russia, who then will form an alliance with France and Great Britain. On the other side, you're going to see Austria-Hungary, who is a joint nation at this time. They are going to form an alliance with Germany. And Germany will form an alliance with the Ottoman Empire. And so you have all these alliances formed. And it's kind of just a situation that it's so volatile. You could cut the tension with a knife, and all it's going to take is one event, and boom, it's going to explode. Well, that explosion, that one event, is going to be the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria-Hungary. He is assassinated by a group of Serbian thugs. And when Austria-Hungary officials reach out to Serbia to help them find these men and bring them to justice, Serbia declines. Well, they take that as an act of war. And so now the alliance system kicks in. Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia. Well, Russia, who has an alliance with Serbia, now declares war on Austria-Hungary. Germany, who has an alliance with Austria-Hungary, now declares war on Russia. France and Great Britain, who have an alliance with Russia, now declare war on Germany. And we have this full-scale world war, a war we have not seen to this point. And it all started really and truly because of the idea of social Darwinism, you know, the survival of the fittest, which led to the alliance system. And once the alliance system was formed, there was no turning back. But when our allies, Great Britain and France, look to us to see what our answer is going to be, Wilson is saying adamantly, we are not getting involved. It is not our job to get involved in this. This is a European matter. We're going to let them handle it. The country does not want to go to war. And he was right. The country, for the most part, at the start of World War I, or the Great War as we called it then, because we didn't know there were going to be two, They wanted no part of the war. They wanted no part of it. And so Wilson kept saying, we are not going to get involved in it. In fact, in his reelection campaign in 1916, his campaign slogan is, he kept us out of war. Now, you don't make that your campaign slogan if that's not a popular theme, if that's not something you're hanging your hat on. The American people didn't want to get involved in it. They wanted to stay out. They wanted to remain isolationists. But what we are going to find, now that we are a world power after the Spanish-American War in 1898, is there are certain things that we cannot stay out of. We can try, and I think Wilson deserves probably more credit than he gets for using as much restraint, is probably the best word I can use, as possible. Not just immediately jumping to war, because he could have easily done that. And I think if Teddy Roosevelt were in office, I don't have to think. I know Teddy Roosevelt, because Teddy Roosevelt criticized Wilson for taking too long. He says, we need to be at war now. What are we waiting on? But I think Wilson deserves a lot of credit for abstaining from just jumping the gun and going to war. The problem for Wilson is he's going to stick to his guns into his second term, but he won't be able to stay out very long. And there's going to be a couple of things that transpire that will change his tune very quickly. Number one, the Germans are using submarines, and they're using unrestricted warfare with those submarines. They're firing not only on warships, but they are firing on passenger ships. And they just so happen to be sinking some American passenger ships. They're sinking French passenger ships that have Americans on board, rather. And we have warned them once already to stop that. We took the first one as, you know, maybe it was a mistake, they didn't know, so we gave them the benefit of the doubt, we warned them against it, and they kind of did the old, okay, we won't, but they've got their fingers crossed behind their back kind of deal. And then they continue to do it. The Lusitania, the Sussex, both were sunk, both had Americans on board, and that is drawing the ire of the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, but he still is maintaining that the United States is going to stay out of the conflict. That is until British intelligence intercepts what we know historically as the Zimmerman Note. And the Zimmerman Note is a letter, a telegram, that is being sent from the Minister of War. His name is Arthur Zimmerman from Germany. And this is from Germany to the country of Mexico. But it was intercepted, allegedly, by British intelligence. And British intelligence reads it. They see that this is of grave concern to the United States, so they deliver it to Washington, D.C. And when it gets to the Oval Office desk of Woodrow Wilson, Wilson reads it. And in this letter, Arthur Zimmerman, the Minister of War from Germany, is offering an alliance to Mexico. And what he is trying to do is get Mexico to join an alliance with them for the remainder of World War I. And when, as the letter says, Germany wins, we will return all the territories lost to Mexico during the Mexican-American War. So territories like parts of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, parts of California, okay? They promised they would return those territories back to Mexico if they joined an alliance with Germany. That is, ladies and gentlemen, the tipping point that draws the United States into World War I. Wilson is livid. This is a guy who is typically very stoic. He's an academic. He's a deep thinker. He processes things. He's very methodical. But when he read the Zimmerman Note, it is said that he lost his cool. And at that moment, he told Congress to begin mobilizing for war. Going to stop it there for the day, and I just want to thank you guys for tuning in. I asked that if you don't mind that you go and subscribe to our podcast, that you give us feedback. I don't care if it's positive or negative. We're trying to learn how to get better at doing this whole podcasting thing. We hope you enjoy it. Next episode, we will pick up with Woodrow Wilson and his involvement in World War I, and we'll talk about his post-war involvement and his 14 points. So I hope that you'll join us for the next episode. And remember, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it.